This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Alyssa Block.
And I'm Audie Cornish. The gothic soap opera Dark Shadows became a cult hit in the 1960s when it introduced supernatural creatures to daytime television. As a little boy, Johnny Depp was obsessed with the show. Now, critic Bob Mondello says he gets to sink his teeth into one of its characters.
Putting together a Halloween costume must be a breeze at Johnny Depp's house. Forget Pirate Jack Sparrow if you just take a few of the characters he's played for director Tim Burton. The Mad Hatter, Mad Barber Sweeney Todd, Mad Candy Maker Willy Wonka, and two Mad Eds, Wood and Scissorhands. You have a whole closet full of costuming possibilities, to which we can now add a madly aristocratic vampire, the one-time heir to Collinwood Mansion, Barnabas Collins, who is thoroughly annoyed at having been rendered immortal and then buried alive by a witch.
Locked in a box for 200 years.
Don't exaggerate. It was only 196.
It was an eternity. I shall have you tried for witchcraft and burnt at the stake.
Poor sweet Barnabas. Things have changed while you were taking your little nap.
The year is 1972, and things have indeed changed. Cars, lava lamps, hippies, there's a lot for an undead 18th century gentleman to take in. But Barnabas, who sees the now dilapidated Collinwood Mansion as a fixer-upper, will do his best to rescue his penniless family, even if distant relatives, like his teenaged great-great-great-great-grandniece, find his pre-Victorian views a bit perplexing.
What is your age, if I may?
15.
15 and no husband. You must put those birthing hips to good use at once, lest your womb shrivel up and die.
You're weird.
As you can hear, Tim Burton's Dark Shadows is more a vampire-out-of-water story than it is an homage to the original TV show, or a trek through the hipper worlds of Twilight and Buffy the Vampire Slayer. It's stately with a smirk, crossing Bram Stoker with the Addams Family to arrive at what sometimes feels like an overproduced Saturday Night Live sketch.
He told me everything, including the fact that you've known his secret since the minute he arrived! What the hell didn't you say anything?!
I was protecting the children.
Oh, by letting a vampire use one of the guest bedrooms!
Screenwriter Seth Graham Smith also has Abraham Lincoln Vampire Hunter coming out later this summer, so he'll have a chance to tap another vein, as it were, of the vampire myth. Here, despite the presence of Helena Bonham Carter and Michelle Pfeiffer, the jokes only really have much bite when they're being cleverly undersold by Johnny Depp. The film is otherwise handsome, vaguely true to the old soap opera, and inert. Toward the end of the movie, Tim Burton offers some visual nods to Nosferatu, Hitchcock's Rebecca, and of all things, Death Becomes Her, suggesting that at some point he may have had broader satirical notions batting around his head. But what he's actually put on screen is just kind of batty. I'm Bob Mondello.
The star of John Irving's new novel, In One Person, his 13th book, is Billy Abbott. Billy is a character who is at the mercy of his own teenage crushes, which are visited upon a whole repertory company of gender-bending characters. And it is a repertory company. Billy spends many a day backstage at the local theater, where his family members are regulars. For instance, his grandfather.
Harry Marshall played all kinds of women. My grandfather loved the theater, and I loved watching him perform. But perhaps there were folks in First Sister, Vermont, who had rather limited imaginations. They knew Harry Marshall was a lumberman. They couldn't accept him as a woman. I told Grandpa Harry about watching some of our fellow townspeople who were caught in the act of watching him. "You know what I say, Bill?" Grandpa Harry asked me. "I say, you can make believe what you want." There were tears in my eyes then because I was afraid for myself, not unlike the way, as a child, I had been afraid backstage for Grandpa Harry. I stole Elaine Hadley's bra because I wanted to wear it, I blurted out. "Ah, well, that's a good fella's failing, Bill. I wouldn't worry about that," Grandpa Harry said. It was strange what a relief it was to see that I couldn't shock him. Harry Marshall was only worried about my safety, as I'd once been afraid for his.
In One Person is a coming-of-age novel in which that person, Billy Abbott, grows up relationship by relationship, some with women, some with men, some with people who may be a bit of both. We asked John Irving, who recently turned 70, about the effect desire can have at a young age.
There's a moment, I think, in most of our childhood years, those prepubescent bordering on puberty years. Those aren't the easiest parts of ourselves for many of us to remember. But I remember that in my imagination, I was at one time or another attracted to just about everyone, to my friends' mothers, to girls my own age, even to some older boys on the wrestling team. Well, as it turned out, I liked girls, but I think a part of our tolerance for sexual differences surely comes from being honest about what we remember of ourselves. So I just tried to be, in this novel, faithful to what utter havoc the mutability of gender can be for many young people in their formative years.
This novel takes place against a backdrop of a lot of references to great works of theater, including Shakespeare and Ibsen. What was it about these works that appealed to you when telling this story of identity?
I got my storytelling from the theater. My mother was a prompter in a small town theater, and I did grow up, much as Billy does, backstage. As a child, every play I saw, I had seen in rehearsal, sometimes for months. I knew everything that happened. I knew what the actors said before they spoke their lines. People have commented, sometimes with irritation, sometimes nicely, on the amount of foreshadow that there is in my novels. Well, yeah, it's not so hard to foreshadow what's coming when you know what's coming, when you are writing to, as I do, a predetermined ending. I begin my novels knowing what happens. I write endings first. I write last sentences, sometimes last paragraphs first. I write collision course stories. There is always something coming that the reader anticipates. What you can't know is when and who the casualties will be and who the survivors will be. But you see the what. You know what's coming. The collision that's coming in one person, I think it's pretty evident in the early going. You're hearing a story about the development and the growing self-awareness of a bisexual boy. It's the 1950s and 60s, and you know you are listening to the voice of an older man who is, he tells you, almost 70. You know that many of these characters you're meeting are going to coincide with the AIDS epidemic. You just don't know when or how or who's going to come out the other side and who isn't. That's not a surprise.
Is it different to write about sexuality when you're in your 70s than, say, when you're in your 30s?
Well, maybe you can be a little more forthright or a little more honest about it because you no longer have anything to protect. You're past that time in your life where you're imagining yourself as sexually attractive to someone. I just think as an older person, you can be more candid with yourself about who you were and how thoroughly intimidating and confusing and conflicted the world of adult sexuality seemed when you were on the doorstep of it, but still standing outside.
Mr. Irving, you're perhaps the only novelist I know who's in the Wrestling Hall of Fame. What do you find so continually fascinating about wrestling?
Many of my wrestling friends find it odd that I'm a writer, just as many of my friends in the writing world find it odd that I was for so many years a wrestler and a wrestling coach. but they seem very similar to me. In both cases, you have to be devoted to tireless repetition and small details. For many more hours than you will ever be in competition, you will be with a nameless workout partner, a sparring partner, drilling the same outside single leg dive, inside collar tie, hundreds upon thousands of times. Well, how many times as a writer do you, or should you, rewrite the same sentence, the same paragraph, the same chapter? If you're good, you'd never tire of that.
There's one difference that occurs to me. Wrestling is now, it's a spectator sport for you. You're still a major participant in writing. What's your next match?
Well, I began a new novel on Christmas Eve. My youngest son of three was home for Christmas, and he came into my office and said, he said, "It's Christmas Eve. What are you doing, writing a new novel?" And I said, "Yes, I think I am, actually. I think I just have." So I don't intend to stop. Dropping dead at my desk sounds like a pretty good idea to me.
John Irving, his 13th novel, is In One Person. Mr. Irving, thanks so much.
Thank you.
At Fenway Park in Boston, it was supposed to be a banner season, the ballpark's 100th anniversary. But the Red Sox are stuck in the basement of their division. They've lost 11 of their last 12 home games. And that is jeopardizing a major league record, the sellout record. Ever since 2003, the Sox have sold out Fenway Park for every game, 727 consecutive games. From member station WBUR in Boston, Kurt Nickisch reports.
You don't normally see scalpers outside Fenway like this guy.
Great box seats, great price, ball face.
Ken Samuelian is a banker. He's a season ticket holder and never used to have any problem unloading extras. But here he is before last night's game, still wearing his suit from work, but no takers.
I don't know what they did with this team this year, but boy, they really laid an egg.
Great box seats, great price.
He's not the only one here shaking his head at how demand to see games is falling. Chip Case is a Red Sox fan and a renowned economist. He's never seen ticket resale prices here drop this low.
Even last year during the fade, when they weren't very popular, you found them selling for 1.5 or 2 times face value. And now I have $130 tickets, and come here to buy those same tickets, you probably get them for $20, maybe $10.
Some tickets sold for less than $4 yesterday. That's less than half the cost of a beer at the ballpark. Not exactly comforting to Brian Matt. The CEO of a local company spent $57,000 this season for a set of premium tickets.
Now I can't even give some of them away. I have a whole staff of 35 people here, and does anybody want tickets? No, not really.
Matt's glad he split the ticket package with a couple of friends before the season started.
It's hard to fall in love with this team.
This season's lackluster performance is endangering the record streak of sold-out games.
This streak is a fragile thing, and it will end at some point.
Sam Kennedy is a top Red Sox executive. He has it easier than his counterparts at other ballparks because Fenway has fewer seats, around 37,000. Kennedy expects the streak to continue for months at least, partly thanks to fans who bought tickets before the season while they were still optimistic, and tourists who want to see a game during Fenway Park's century season.
For people to suggest that we would just give away tickets to get to a certain sellout metric or level is silly. We don't do that. We won't do that.
While many Sox fans take pride in the streak, there are at least some who wouldn't mind seeing it come to an end.
Maybe this is the year that we'll go to at least a game and maybe a couple of games.
Leslie McPherson-Artinian hasn't taken her family to a game for the past 6 years. At an average Fenway ticket price of more than $50, it's just been too expensive. She remembers going to games with her parents. She's been a fan ever since 1967 when she was 7 years old and the Red Sox went to the World Series.
It's the background noise of my life. And I wish, you know, I wish we could go to more games just so it could be that way for my boys, too.
This season, her wish is coming true. For NPR News, I'm Kurt Nikisch in Boston.
That is the trashy sound of the garbage men, Ira.
Oh, that's not very nice, trashy.
No, I mean it literally. It's literally picked out of the trash. The garbage men is a band of five high school kids from Florida, and they make their instruments, the ones that you're hearing them playing, with stuff that they rescue from the trash or even find on the side of the road. So, you know, no need to spend big bucks on a Stratocaster when you can use an empty Fruit Loops box, a yardstick, and some duct tape. No drum kit? How about a 5-gallon bucket and a trash can lid? E-flat contrabass bugle? You get the idea. So joining me now to talk about this is the band and their signature recycled sound. Is Jack Barry. He's the guitar player for the Garbage Men, and also with me is Ollie Gray. That's the band's drummer. They're both students at Pine View School in Osprey, Florida. Welcome to Science Friday, guys.
Hi. Hello.
Thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having us. Yeah, great to be on.
Well, let's talk about these instruments. Why don't you give us a run-through of the instruments you play and what they're made of?
All right. Well, I'm Jack, and I play the guitar, which is a one-string guitar made from a Cheerios cereal box with a yardstick for the neck and toothpicks for frets. Then we have Ollie over here.
Yeah, I play the drums. I have a big black trash can for my bass drum. It's a big plastic trash can. My cymbals are two metal trash can lids. And for my tom drum, I use a water jug, and that's placed upside down in a bucket for maximum sound. We also have saxophones made from a kid's toy and a balloon.
Ooh, I want to hear more about that in just one second. You're listening to Science Friday on NPR. I'm Flora Lichtman with Ira Flato, and the Garbage Men, high school students who have this awesome band where they play instruments made from recycled material. So tell me about the saxophone.
Well, it's made from a Fisher-Price corn popper toy, and that makes up the body. It kind of looks like a saxophone. And we took a old PVC pipe, drilled some holes in it for the sound, and then for the reed, we used part of a balloon.
Ooh.
So it's kind of like a kazoo, but it sounds like a saxophone.
You can, by the way, see a video of the Garbage Men on our website at sciencefriday.com. It's definitely, definitely worth a look. I think you're rocking out at a farmer's market in it. Does that sound right, guys? So where did the idea for this come from? Who started this band?
Well, originally Jack had made a guitar out of a cereal box and a yardstick, and he had brought it to school to show some people. And I thought that was just a really great idea, so I told him that I thought it would be nice if we made an entire band out of instruments like these, just to, like, see what we could make for, like, each instrument. And that really just blossomed into what it is today. Like, I think back then there were three instruments, and now we have, I'd say eight off the top of my head.
Jack, where did you get the idea for that initial guitar?
I just wanted to build myself an instrument, and those were the materials I had lying around. I didn't go out thinking, hey, wouldn't it be cool to make a band out of garbage? But it just kind of turned out that way, because those are the things I had lying around the house.
Is there a piece of garbage you'd like to have that you haven't garbage picked yet?
Well, I've been looking for some cool-shaped things that kind of look like other instruments.
I've been looking for a metal mailbox that won't fall apart after, like, one gig, because those have the ultimate sound.
Okay, well, anyone in your neighborhood is listening, maybe they...
I've got one.
Could donate. Ira, you could get a Science Friday mailbox. So have the instruments changed much? Have you learned anything about making these instruments since you began?
Yeah, definitely. I've learned through trial and error with making the instruments. The very first guitar I made, the neck was really bendy and it couldn't stay in tune. But through trial and error, making different instruments, they've definitely improved. The very first saxophone we made,
actually didn't work that well because the balloon started to vibrate at a different overtone than normally would have. But we fixed that so it didn't squeak anymore.
Oh, nice. Do you guys play gigs?
Yeah, every weekend we do.
Yeah, all weekend, every weekend, all weekend.
So where's your next gig so we can come see it?
Ooh. Well, we're actually playing at a festival in Tampa, in Ybor City, Tampa, Florida. It's called Tropical Heat Wave.
Very cool.
Wow.
Yeah. Have you played? What do people at school think? Are people trying to get in on the band?
Not really. They don't think much of it because, like, I mean, it's not really that big or, like, showy or anything like that, like a lot of other bands at school are with some other people in them. But definitely there are some people that like it, though, and, well, no one's really invested enough interest to, like, want to be in it or anything along those lines. Definitely there is, like, at least a small bit of support.
Yeah. We'll wait to see it on Glee soon. We'll know you've made it.
Yeah, absolutely. I think they're going to play us out today, Ira. Jack Berry and Ollie Gray are two of the members of the Garbage Men Band, and look for them in front of the Whole Foods in Sarasota on May 19th. Or if you want to schedule upcoming gigs, go to their website. You'll find some links to their schedule, and we have all the info on our website at sciencefriday.com. Thanks, guys, for coming on the show.
Thank you. Thanks.
Thank you, Flora. And that's about all the time we have for today. Our program senior producer is Annette Heist. Charles Berquist is our director. Flora is our multimedia editor. Associate senior producer, Christopher Intagliata. Namisha Saranan is our producer. Luis Quevedo is our Spanish language producer. Sam Flato is our production assistant. Neil Rauch, our technical director at the controls here in New York. Our iPhone app produced by Pastime Software. Wayne Hoxie does our Android app. And holy mackerel, go over to our website. Something's happened to it. Whoa, you won't recognize it. It's all new, updated website, and we'd love to hear your comments about it and enjoy it. Have a great weekend. We'll see you next week. I'm Ira Flato in New York.
A story about Mitt Romney's behavior in high school has his campaign on the defensive. The Washington Post has published a long story that details incidents of bullying by Romney when he was a senior at the Tony Cranbrook Boys Prep School in Michigan. Five former classmates spoke about an incident when Romney led a posse that targeted a student with long, bleached blonde hair, tackled him, pinned him to the ground, and hacked off his hair as he cried and screamed for help. It's the first topic for our weekly political chat with columnists E.J. Dionne of The Washington Post, who joins us today from Pittsburgh, and David Brooks of The New York Times here in the studio. Welcome to you both.
Good to be here.
Good to be with you.
And let's hear first from Mitt Romney. He was asked about this story yesterday on Fox News.
I don't recall the incident myself, but I've seen the reports and not going to argue with that. There's no question but that I did some stupid things when I was in high school. And obviously, if I hurt anyone by virtue of that, I would be very sorry for it and apologize for it.
Now, David, the boy who was targeted later came out as gay. His family has said in a statement they are aggrieved that he would be used to further a political agenda. But some of his former classmates say they still feel haunted by what they did. Do you think this story is fair game? Does this incident from 1965 tell us anything about candidate Romney in 2012?
No. You know, it was a cruel episode, but it happens when he was a teenager. There's no record of him doing anything like that. If you report around Mitt Romney these days, you're bombarded with stories of him showing compassion and concern. And so those are the stories that characterize his adult life, not sort of a gotcha story about something that happened in a high school. So I don't think it's terribly meaningful. I think it's sort of gotcha journalism. It plays into the partisanship. It also plays into part of the stupidity of our politics, which is one stain on a person becomes infuriating for everybody. We are incredibly complicated, mottled creatures. We're all flawed, and we're all bound to have something like this in our past. To go digging through high school seems to me is illegitimate.
And E.J. David Brooks calling this gotcha journalism. How do you see it?
I disagree with David. I agree we are all flawed. But beyond that, I think that you're not talking here about something that somebody did as a teenager that was stupid or silly or crazy or fun-loving. This was downright mean. And I do think it raises questions that people are going to have in their heads about Romney. Why did he behave like this? The New York Times, writing about the Washington Post story, I thought had it right when they said the Romney campaign has to start worrying that a story like this, especially if there are other stories like this, will create the image of him as a rich kid with a mean streak, which is not exactly a category people like to vote for. And I got to say that kind of if I did anything that caused offense, blah, blah, blah kind of apology is just not very good form. So I think the danger is that people are going to ask, does this or does this not say something about who Romney is? And we'll find out more, including what he's like as an adult. Maybe he put this all behind him, but I think it was a very disturbing story.
This report, of course, follows closely on the heels of President Obama's interview in which he said he does support same-sex marriage. There's been a lot of talk about how that may hurt or help him with different voting groups, but I want to talk instead about how significant this is for the president to make this affirmation, how important you think it may be for history, and what, if anything, changes by this. David Brooks, you first.
Yeah, I think it's important for history. The issue is obviously been evolving incredibly rapidly. It's almost unprecedented to see an issue evolve this rapidly. Nonetheless, I don't think this will have a big political or governmental effect because he's more or less leaving it up to the states, but it'll have an important symbolic impact on the country. I think it'll move it in, from my perspective, forward on gay marriage. I do have to say I think it'll hurt him politically. I think if you look at states like North Carolina, Ohio, Pennsylvania, Colorado, Missouri, a lot of these states have passed anti-gay marriage. There's still 50, 40, 60% of the people who are opposed to gay marriage. To the extent that the issue matters in the fall, I think it'll hurt him politically and therefore making it probably a little more brave on a matter of principle.
And EJ, Joe Biden beat the president to the punch on this one, but were you surprised that the president said what he did?
In the end, no. And if you'll forgive me for doing this, Melissa, I want to honor my friend David Brooks, who was a very early conservative proponent of gay marriage and really made a powerful conservative case for this on the grounds that if you care about fidelity and commitment, which is actually a conservative thing to care about, you ought to be for gay marriage. And that's why opinion has moved so much in just 8 years on this. You can see from the caution of the Republicans in dealing with this that they know this is not 2004 when President Bush's campaign could use a gay marriage to turn out a lot of votes. And in the end, I think Joe Biden may have done Barack Obama a favor here because Obama's position before Biden spoke was that his position was evolving. You can't go out on the campaign trail and defend an evolving position. You have to have a position. And I think he's much better off to be clear and not clear. And I think the politics are mixed. There are some votes he may lose. I think he may pick up a little bit among upscale social liberals. But he may get a lot more energy among young people, and he really needs it because that energy among young people has not been out there like it was in 2008.
And finally, why don't we take a turn to Europe and the economic populist anger that helped bring down French President Nicolas Sarkozy over elections last weekend and is creating still more turmoil in Greece. Anti-austerity forces on the march in Europe. David, what are the implications here at home?
First, I want to be clear on what austerity is. The French, the British, the Italians, none of these people have actually cut spending. Spending is still going up on all those countries. They have, in many cases, raised taxes. And so to the extent we're talking about the pain of austerity, it's not spending cuts, it's tax increases. Nonetheless, I do think Europe is in much bigger turmoil than we thought 3 or 4 months ago. I think that, combined with the slowdown in China, really imperils the U.S. economy to an extent we didn't think 6 months ago. And to that extent, if we look around the world, Gordon Brown in Britain, Sarkozy in France, voters are throwing people out. And in a tough economy, it just got a little tougher because of the turmoil about to still mounting in Europe.
EJ?
Well, I think this was a very useful lesson because the austerity, especially in Britain, certainly included a lot of spending cuts. It was about 3-to-1 spending cuts. And I think Hollande's victory and what happened in Greece, where the voters rejected both major parties, says that we're not going to get out of this mess just by cutting, just by saying, well, we need to get our budget in balance and everything will be okay in the long run because business and investors will have confidence. No, we need to do something to boost living standards and create jobs. And so Hollande is a moderate. He's a moderate social democrat. I think he's going to push Angela Merkel and others in Europe to get that economy moving a little bit before you impose some cuts in government, which over the long run they need, but you got to get the short run right if you're going to have any hope for the long run.
Well, thanks to you both, E.J. Dionne of the Washington Post and Brookings Institution, David Brooks of the New York Times. Have a great weekend.
You too.
Good to be with you.
The British have been holding a public inquiry into press ethics for the last few months. The government is responding to the outcry over the phone hacking scandal at Rupert Murdoch's News of the World. The inquiry is investigating the way newspapers, the police, and politicians may feed off each other, and that means shining a light into the secluded world, in particular of the Prime Minister's social set. And NPR's Philip Reeves has been watching the questioning.
By that point, you were quite friendly with Mr. Cameron, weren't you?
Yes.
Rebecca Brooks is on the stand. She ran Murdoch's powerful British newspapers until the scandal forced her to resign. Robert Jay, counsel to the inquiry, is on a quest. He wants to know if there was anything corrupt in the relationship between Murdoch's empire and the politicians who govern Britain. Jay begins exploring Brooks's friendship with Prime Minister David Cameron.
He attended a New Year's Eve party at your farm, didn't he? Your husband's farm.
Yes, but not at our home. It was my sister-in-law's party.
Cameron and Brooks are members of what's become known in Britain as the Chipping Norton Set.
The Chipping Norton Set is the name that's been given to a group of people who've sort of centred around the Conservative Party and News International employees who've all got second homes in or around Chipping Norton. I wouldn't say in Chipping Norton because it's a town and they like their farms and they like their livestock and they like their horses and their gardens.
That's author and journalist Rachel Johnson, editor of The Lady magazine. Chipping Norton is about 75 miles northwest of London. It's in Oxfordshire.
Where you have these honey-stoned villages and incredibly expensive farm shops and rolling countryside over which they all ride to hounds together. And this is where the deals are done and the contacts are made and the friendships are forged.
At the centre of this set are David Cameron and his wife Samantha. Around them revolves a group that includes Rebecca Brooks, her husband Charlie, a racehorse trainer, Rupert Murdoch's second daughter, Elizabeth, and her husband Matthew Freud, a PR executive. Perhaps the group's most globally famous member is this man.
The trouble is, none of these cars are really small. They are, in fact, massive.
Jeremy Clarkson, presenter of the TV motoring show Top Gear. The term Chipping Norton Set was first coined by Stephen Glover, a political columnist with the Daily Mail. Glover says its members should not be confused with the traditional English aristocracy.
No, absolutely not. They're not at all the British aristocracy. Rebecca Brooks is, you know, just an ordinary girl, as it were. I think Cameron is just a member of the privileged upper middle classes. Jeremy Clarkson is not an aristocrat.
Glover says the Chipping Norton Set behave pretty much like any other very wealthy people.
They have dinner parties, they have drinks parties, they have drinks in each other's houses. There's also a sort of country element in as much as Rebecca Brooks is a keen rider and so is David Cameron. And there's recently been quite a lot of hilarious publicity about how David Cameron rode a horse, which had been lent to Rebecca Brooks by the Metropolitan Police in London. They no longer needed it.
Wait a minute. The Prime Minister riding a horse lent by the cops to a woman from the tacky world of Murdoch's tabloids? Isn't this all a bit bizarre? But England is rather bizarre. And, says Rachel Johnson, very cliquey.
I'm afraid I don't live in a meritocracy or a democracy. I live in a mateocracy, where it completely depends on who you know, who's godfather to your child, where you went to school, and where you hunt.
The Camerons and the Brookses won't be hunting together for a while. Glover says the hiatus over the phone hacking scandal has changed the Chipping Norton Set.
It'll never be the same again. the central relationship in the Chipping Norton Set was between Rebecca Brooks and David Cameron, and that is broken forever.
Philip Reeves, NPR News, London.
You're listening to NPR News.